This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Astronomers announced in October that they had found a planet in Alpha Centauri, which is 4.4 light years away. And astronomically speaking, that's practically in our neighborhood. While it shares some characteristics with the Earth, it is too hot to be habitable. More recently, astronomers discovered evidence of a planet more massive than the Earth that's 42 light years away. Michael Lemanek has been following these discoveries, and the planeteers who use high-tech telescopes to scan the universe looking for something called exoplanets. Lemanek is a senior writer for Climate Central and the author of a new book called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. And Michael Lemanek joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
So what does it mean to be a twin of the Earth?
Well, it means different things depending on how complicated you want to get. So strictly speaking, it means a planet that's the same size as the Earth, made of the same stuff as the Earth, orbiting a star like the Sun at about the same distance of the Earth so that it's comfortable for life.
There have been these interesting discoveries over the last couple of weeks, even last couple of months. Does that tell us that this is a kind of a coincidence of discovery, or that we are making real progress in understanding our universe?
Oh, no, we're making huge progress. The first planets were discovered orbiting stars other than the Sun in 1995. And those planets were very weird. They were gigantic, like Jupiter, but they were orbiting their stars very close with years that lasted only 4 days. So they were very hot. They were very bizarre. And it was exciting to find anything, but astronomers really are interested in whether there's life out there in the universe, so they wanted something like a mirror Earth. And in recent years, especially with the Kepler mission, NASA's Kepler mission, and with new observing techniques from the ground, they've gotten closer and closer and closer to finding a true twin of Earth, and we are just on the verge.
And how many planets since 1995 have been discovered?
So there are something like 2,000 planets that are almost certainly real. 800 or 900 of them have been absolutely confirmed, but the rest are almost certainly real discoveries as well.
And they all have names.
No.
Some of them have names.
You wouldn't call them names. So you have Kepler 10b and Kepler 11b and WASP 12b and Corot 7. These are names that no normal person would remember.
This discovery in October of this planet in Alpha Centauri, what do we know about that?
Well, we know that this is a planet that is very much like the Earth in mass, so it weighs about as much as the Earth. That might mean it's made of the same stuff that we are, or it could be a big blob of water or something bizarre like that. So all we know is its mass. We don't really know what it's made of. And we also know that it's a very, very hot planet, because it too, like some of those early discoveries, has a surface temperature of about 2,000 degrees.
Oh, and how do we know that?
We know it simply because we know how far away it is from the star. We know how bright the star is. So, you just do the math, or somebody does the math, and you know what the temperature should be.
And just as I said in my intro, that's 4.4 light years away, relatively close, I guess, astronomically speaking.
It's the very closest star system to Earth. There is no star closer than the three in the Alpha Centauri system. So, yeah, it's right next door. I mean, it would take a long, long time to get there with our current technology. But still, if you have planets in that system, and if there are others besides this one especially, it is within the capability of observing directly with telescopes that we have. And that's a way to really start to understand what these planets are like.
Now, I was reading something that's 4.4 light years away. I guess by today's travel, it would take 40,000 years to get there.
Something like that.
So
it's not likely. The Voyager spacecraft, which is just on the edge of exiting the solar system, is the fastest moving spacecraft we have. It would take 40,000 years. If it were going in that direction, it would take 40,000 years to get there. It's not going in that direction.
No, it isn't. But how do they find this planet?
Well, so those very first planets I talked about were discovered by looking at the stars. You can't see the planets themselves. They're too small, and the star is too bright. So you look at the star itself, and you can watch to see how its light changes very subtly as the planet tugs it back and forth. And it changes actually the light reaching us in a regular way. So what actually happens is that as the planet is on the far side and pulls the star away from us, it's like gets a little bit redder. And as the planet circles around and is pulling the star just a little bit toward us, it gets a little bit bluer, a tiny bit. And by measuring that, and by how much that's happening and how often, they can tell what the mass of the planet is. And so that's what they did in 1995. That's what they've done now with much, much higher precision for this new planet.
So essentially watching this wobble, I guess, as
right.
it's called.
Right, right. So if you see the star wobbling, you know that something is pulling on it. And that's got to be a planet. We don't really know of anything else that could be doing that.
What do they do next? I mean, so you identify, you find what looks like a planet. Then what happens?
Well, then you... you do one of a couple of things. You keep looking even harder at that system, because if there's one planet there, there's likely to be more than one. And the one you see first is the easiest one to see. It has the biggest effect on the star. But there are others. If there are others, they will also have a set of wobbles that are sort of superimposed. If you looked at our sun, you would see it wobbling on eight different frequencies based on the eight different planets that we have in our solar system. And Jupiter would be relatively easy to see because it's so massive. Mercury is tiny. Earth is tiny and far away. So you've got these superimposed wobbles. And if you can untangle those, you can figure out what other planets are there. So that's the first thing. Second thing is you look carefully to see if the planet literally passes directly in front of the star. And if it does that, it will make the light of the star dim just a tiny bit. And that gives you a handle not only on the mass, but on the size of the planet, the physical size. Because if it dims 10%, then you're covering 10% of the star. And if you combine the mass and the size, you can get the density and figure out what it's made of.
Does that tell you about day and night?
No. So it's kind of complicated. If a planet is relatively close to the star, it's going to be affected by tidal forces, and it's going to turn one face to the star at all times, the way the moon turns one face to us at all times. So with planets that are very close in, there is no day and night, or it's always day on one side, it's always night on the other.
Huh.
And you can calculate that also by the laws of physics, whether that's likely to happen.
Your book is about these exoplaneteers. I mean, this is what they call themselves.
This is what some of them call themselves.
Yeah.
And I like the term so much, I just...
I think it's a great term.
Yeah, no, I love it.
And exo meaning outside of our solar system, right?
Exactly.
And these are the people that they're finding, I guess, what we have been talking about.
Yes. So in 1995, I keep going back to that year because that's when the first one was discovered. There were about three of them. No, there were about five of them in the world, because it was considered to be such a difficult thing to do that it was a waste of time even to bother. And there were a couple of them out there anyway, and they were determined. And sure enough, they started to find these planets. And as soon as they did, everybody else woke up and said, oh, my goodness, this is possible. We didn't believe it. Now we do. We've got to get into this business because it's so exciting. And there was a flood of astronomers from other areas in astronomy who switched over to doing this. And there was also a kind of a switch among graduate students and postdoctoral students who had been planning to study the Big Bang and things like that, and suddenly realized, here's a much more exciting thing to do with my career. So most of the exoplaneteers I talk about in this book, or many of them at least, are sort of that younger generation who woke up and said, hey, I'd rather do this. And they've brought their incredible talent and dedication and skill to this business.
And who came up with the phrase or the term exoplaneteer?
It is my understanding that it was a guy named Dave Charbonneau at Harvard who created a group. He's doing his own observing project looking for exoplanets. And he would send out emails to this small group of maybe 8 or 10 people that he worked with. And he would always start, "Dear exoplaneteers, come for pizza on Wednesday and we'll discuss the latest research."
Yeah, but it fits, doesn't it?
It does. It's great.
There are several of these people that you write about. A guy named Bill, whose last name just flew right out of my head.
Bill Borucki?
Borucki, yes.
Yes. So the story of the exoplaneteers is a generational one. And I mentioned that there were a few, there was a handful of them back in the early 90s who wanted to do this, and everybody else said, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And Bill Borucki was one of that generation. He had originally worked on the Apollo missions. He designed heat shields to help protect mm-hmm. the astronauts as they came in. And he gradually changed his interest to searching for exoplanets. And in as early as the 1980s, he proposed a mission to go looking for them. Turned out to be the Kepler mission eventually. And he was looking not for wobbles in stars, but for these the dimming mm-hmm. as planets passed in front of them. And he wrote up a proposal, and he sent it into NASA, and they said, no. And he went back and redid the proposal, and they said, no, no, too expensive. And he went back and said, well, you know, I've got the cost down. They said, no, you don't have detectors good enough. And he went back and made detectors that were good enough. They said, no, you still can't. He went four or five times back to NASA, and they kept shooting him down. And he just wouldn't give up. And as a result, he got the Kepler mission launched in 2009, which is something like 25 years after his first foray into this business. And it's been the most spectacular success that NASA's had in recent years.
Well, let me quote someone talking about Bill Borucki, saying it really takes a unique person to create a mission like this. Bill has this personality trait where negativity just rolls off him. He doesn't accept it at all.
Yes, and it seems to be true. I mean, he would get shot down, and some people in that position, and there have been people in that position, they propose a mission and get shot down. They say, well, okay, I'll go think about something else. And he would just get up the next day and say, okay, how can I change my proposal? How can I improve it so that they will accept it? Because I know this is a great mission.
Right. And NASA, I mean, obviously, he kept coming back with another proposal. They kept shooting it down. I mean, at some point they must have, and especially with all the success that the Kepler mission has had, they must be thanking him for a job well done.
Absolutely. He is a big NASA celebrity now.
Yeah. And because of his doggedness, right?
Because of his doggedness.
I mean, did he know he was right? I mean, did he know that if he could get this thing launched, we would have these discoveries that we're having
now? So the idea of this mission was to find out how many planets there are out there. On average, how many stars have planets? And nobody really did know the answer. And finding that very few stars had planets around them would also have been a success. The simple idea behind this mission was to say, what are we dealing with out here? What kind of a universe do we have? And, I mean, I'm sure he hoped there were lots of planets, but he didn't know that he would find lots of planets. What he did know was that he could build a spacecraft that could answer that question.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Michael Lemonick. And he has a new book. It's called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. The book is about the Kepler mission, also about a number of these exoplaneteers who are determined to explore our universe and answer some very important questions about planets and stars and our place in the universe. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs including clinical psychology, criminal justice, public administration, liberal studies, and more, giving students hands-on leadership experience designed to help advance careers in today's challenging economy. More online at widener.edu. That's widener.edu to learn more. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works. Widener University supports WHYY.
Serving in a war zone can leave scars, both seen and unseen for many service members. But what about the people the nation's warriors turn to when they need to talk? In honor of Veterans Day, we hear the story of military social workers and the battles they face both on and off the field of battle. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and joint disease. Their team of fellowship-trained and board-certified joint replacement surgeons, rheumatologists, and physical therapists are committed to using an advanced approach to joint care, individualized for each patient. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, with locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. More at cooperhealth.org/ortho or 800-8-COOPER.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Is there another world out there somewhere in the universe that acts and behaves like the Earth? That is a question that has both inspired and confounded human beings for thousands of years. But scientists are getting closer to answering that question with the development of high-tech telescopes and other new technology. And talking with Michael Lemonick, author of a new book called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. His book is about these exoplaneteers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, you talk about the fact that there are these amazing astronomers, these exoplaneteers doing extraordinary work. But you also had a piece recently about how difficult it has been for them because we haven't, I guess, as a country, invested in the kind of technology that they really need to go even farther than what they've already gone.
Right. So back in 1995, when they first started finding these planets, NASA was very excited. Of course, mm-hmm. They like things that get the public excited.
Sure.
So they said we're gonna have a series of telescopes, space telescopes, that are going to let you find planets much more easily, and they involve very complicated technology. But we're going to get on this, and we're going to, by 2020, we're going to have a telescope up there in space that will let you actually take an image of a planet. And so you can study the atmosphere and understand whether there are molecules that suggest that there's life, whether there are gases that are given off by living things. And everybody was very thrilled, and people got to work, and there were some grants initially from NASA. And as the years went on and budgets got tighter and tighter, these projects were either slowed down or canceled entirely or put on the back burner. And the result is that today we really don't have the technology to study these planets nearly the way that we would like to.
Well, and just to give some names here, the Space Interferometry Mission, SIM.
Yes.
That's one.
That's one.
And there's the James Webb Space Telescope. I guess that's another.
Yes. Yeah, so that's the only thing that's actually getting built. And originally it was called the Next Generation Space Telescope. They were calling it the NGST. And then it was named for James Webb, who is a NASA administrator. Some of us would have liked to have seen it named after a great astronomer.
Oh, interesting.
But NASA administrator. And what's happened over the years, that was... In theory, that was going to be up in space by 2007. And here we are in 2012, and they're working on it, and they've got the mirrors built, and they're putting it all together, but it's smaller than they wanted it to be. They originally planned it to be because of money,
right.
And it's way behind schedule. It's going to launch in 2018, if we're lucky.
And is it just... budget cutting? I mean, this has been across the board for a lot of government agencies.
Right. Budget cutting. And especially at NASA, the budget for human spaceflight is the lion's share of what the agency spends money on. And all of these extraordinary missions to Mars, the Curiosity rover that's out on Mars right now and getting so much attention, deservedly, or the mission that's en route to Pluto, which is going to get there in 2015, or some of the other small space missions that do so much spectacular science, is really just the tip of the iceberg of what scientists would like to see. But that takes up a tiny fraction of NASA's budget.
But do you think that's a PR thing? I mean, it's hard not to feel some connection to Curiosity. I mean, especially with a name like that.
Absolutely.
On Mars, and you can get information back about what Curiosity is finding up there.
Well, NASA is very clever about using the money it has and also promoting the discoveries it makes. And, yes, it's PR, but it's not like you're selling a new shampoo or something where it's dubious that it's any different from the old shampoo. I mean, these missions are making real scientific discoveries, and if NASA's, you know, doing a little PR about it, I think it's great.
But are you also saying that we can do all of this, and we should and need to be doing all of this?
Saying that we could, I mean, could is a funny word. We could if we spent the money, and if we spent, you know, if we took, 1% of the Pentagon budget and put it into space science, we would make a dramatic difference. But politically, it's just not going to happen, or it's not going to happen easily.
But are you also saying that we should, in that there's so much information that we can learn about our universe and these other universes?
Selfishly, I'm saying that. Yeah, yes, absolutely. No, because I am really intrigued by this stuff and fascinated and inspired, and I have been ever since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I know many, many other people are too, and it's not going to, it's not going to make companies more profitable necessarily. It's just going to inspire and trigger the imaginations of huge numbers of Americans, which I think is a really good thing.
Do you actually think there is a mirror Earth somewhere?
I'm sure there is. So Kepler went up there to try and find out what percentage of stars have planets and what kind of planets they have. And what Kepler's finding is that a huge percentage of stars have planets, and that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of planets that are probably about the size of Earth out in the universe, out in the Milky Way. And some of these inevitably are going to be in orbits that are favorable for life. Huh. And so, yes, I think there's no question that there is a planet, that there are many planets just like ours out there. And whether there's life on them or not is the next question. And that's something it's hard to speculate about, but we certainly want to know.
And life means water, or I guess some version of water to sustain life.
As far as we know, water is necessary. Liquid water is necessary for life as we know it. And life as we know it is really all we know how to look for.
Sure.
Life as we don't know it, I mean,
how would we know it if we found it? Right.
So that's why we want a planet in what's called the habitable zone of its star. Earth is in the habitable zone. Water is liquid here on much of the planet most of the time.
And is that part of this Goldilocks version, which is not too hot, not too cold?
Right. So the Goldilocks zone is the familiar way to talk about
that. That's how I understand space.
And astronomers use that, when talking to each other. They use the Goldilocks zone, and that's exactly right. So So in our solar system, Mars is too cold, Venus is too hot, Earth is just right.
That's Michael Lemonick, our guest today on Radio Times. We often call him up when there are things to talk about having to do with the universe and space. And he has a new book called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. We've also been talking about some fascinating discoveries in the last couple of weeks, even the last couple of months, that are helping us understand our universe and some of the other universes out there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Mike from Downingtown to join us. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yeah, just touching on a comment you made earlier on how long it would take to get to one of these exoplanets based on current technology. I was wondering what might be on the horizon in the way of propulsion technology, what people are working on, what might be in the future, both private sector and public sector, especially with the Dragon spacecraft.
Oh, interesting, Mike. Yeah, thanks for the call. Can you take that, Mike?
As far as you'll have to remind me of the details of the Dragon spacecraft. I don't think it's designed for interstellar travel. There is some work going on new propulsion technologies like ion propulsion and light sails, which actually use the light from the sun to propel a giant sail dragging a spacecraft, and the force exerted by the light from the sun is very small, but it's cumulative. And if you have a huge light sail,
sail.
Yeah, something big thing made of mylar that actually is propelled by the sun, by the light from the sun. So these things could achieve extremely high speeds, but they're nowhere near ready for use in actual spacecraft.
Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But if we, I mean, we are finding these planets, and if we want to explore them in one way or another, we have to figure out how to get there in less than 40,000 years, right?
Well,
I mean, is that part of the goal?
Yeah, that is... That remember, 40,000 years is for the very closest star. The next one out, you have to. It's going to be 60,000 years, and then it's 100,000 years. And even if you know, even if we tripled the speed, so now it's only 13,000 years. You know, and it would take a remarkable civilization. We're not quite that remarkable to put money into a space probe that will get us results 13,000 years from now. So yes, someday that might be what we try to do, but for the moment, the best way to explore these planets is by building bigger and better telescopes.
Right. I mean, that seems like the, an argument for an investment now to get the information now.
Right. Now people have talked about really creative things like putting together a spacecraft the size of a cell phone, which is much easier to get moving very fast, and send 100 of them out to Alpha Centauri. Oh. And by the time they get there, they'll be going really fast, but they can snap pictures as they go by.
How cool is that?
Yeah, yeah. And it wouldn't be nearly as expensive as a conventional space probe. So there's the same kind of creative thinking going on now in propulsion and in getting to other stars as there was, 50 years ago for getting to the moon.
Is that a crazy idea, the idea of sending cell phones into Alpha Centauri?
No, it's a great idea. The idea being that it's not very expensive and that if you send 50 of them and 45 of them fail, you've still got five. Right. No, that kind of small, cheap space probe is actually a very good idea. And another thing I talk about in the book is a new type of satellite, Earth-orbiting satellite, that's no bigger than a shoebox. And these are real satellites that do limited but real science. Hmm. And, you shoot them up a dozen at a time. And it's extremely cheap.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mike, thanks for the call. Let's see what looks like Daryl from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Daryl, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Given how long it takes for planets to orbit a star, how long do we have to observe a star in order to conclude that that planets are orbiting it, and how many are we able to watch simultaneously?
Okay, good questions. What the Kepler mission has set as its benchmark is that a planet, now remember, Kepler is looking for planets passing directly in front of their stars. I'm doing this with my hand, but I guess you can't see it.
I'm getting the benefit of that, Daryl, but yeah, go ahead.
Pass in front of their stars and make the stars dim just a bit. And Kepler has set a minimum set of orbits at three. So you have to see something. You have to see a star dim three times on a regular schedule before you take it seriously. Mm. And if you're talking about a planet that's orbiting very close to the star, that can happen every 5 days or even shorter. If you're looking for something like the Earth, it's going to happen once a year. And so you need at least 3 years before you can say, yes, I think I've got a planet. The people who are looking at wobbles have the same kind of problem. So there are programs that have been looking at individual stars for a year, 2 years, 5 years, even 10 or 15 years, looking for longer and longer periods, meaning planets further and further out. So nobody's going to just take one blip and say, yes, I've seen a planet. And I forget the rest of the question.
Daryl, did we take care of your question for you?
Sure. And just the other question, how many stars are we actually observing, continuously now?
Okay, so Kepler alone is observing about 150,000 stars, looking straight at the same patch of sky, and it has been since 2009, monitoring the same 150,000 stars. Other probes are, or other observing programs, which involve telescopes, mostly individual telescopes, jump back and forth from one star to the next and keep returning to the same stars, but don't watch them continuously most of the time. And all told, they're probably looking at another 1,000, maybe. I'm just making that up, but it's nowhere near the number that Kepler sees.
Daryl, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just to underscore what you said, what Kepler is just staring at a very small part of the sky and just staring at it.
Just staring at it.
Getting it right.
Right. So it's a telescope designed to look at one place for its entire lifetime.
You write about a number of people. I mentioned this guy, David Charbonneau at Harvard. What do we need to know about him?
Well, he's a guy who was originally planning to discover study the Big Bang in the early universe. He came to Harvard. There was this new thing, this exoplanet thing going on. He got very excited, and he got into that field, and he created a project to look at a different type of star. So right from the beginning, and when you asked me the question in the beginning, what is a mirror Earth, I said, yes, it's got to orbit a star like the sun. Well, why exactly? Well, because we know sun-like stars have planets like Earth. But he thought it might be more profitable to look at a different kind of star, something called an M dwarf, which is smaller, dimmer. They're mostly red in color. They are red in color. And people had thought there was not much chance of finding planets around them or finding life because they tend to be have a lot of flares and a lot of radiation. But some of them don't. And so he started this program to observe these dwarf stars looking for planets passing in front of the star, dimming them. And the advantage of this was that, first of all, the habitable zone is much closer in. They're dimmer, so you need to be closer to be just right, which means their year is shorter. You don't have to look as long to see three transits. Also, the planet is Earth-like planet is bigger compared to the star than we are compared to the sun, so it would block more of the star's light. Huh. So you look for a more pronounced dimming. So it's easier in many ways. And he set up a network of ground-based telescopes to look at these M dwarfs, which are relatively close by. They're too dim to see further out. And in 2009, he actually found what's known as a super Earth, a planet that's bigger than the Earth, but not all that much bigger, was one of the very first super Earths discovered. And it turns out this weird planet is probably half rock and half water with an atmosphere of mostly steam.
So that's an important discovery.
It's an important discovery, and it's important because it's one of the smaller planets found to date. And so he's getting closer and closer to something the size of Earth, which is the ultimate goal. Moreover, it's an indication that not all planets are, if something is like the Earth in size, does not mean it's like the Earth in composition.
Interesting.
And astronomers have realized that planets come in a wide variety of compositions that we had never suspected.
We're almost up on a break here, but from these exoplaneteers that you interviewed for your book, do you see a kind of a common personality trait? Is there something that they share?
Well, they all... okay, that's an interesting question, which nobody has asked me before. They all share a real excitement about what they're doing. So I've written books about cosmologists, people who study the Big Bang and the early universe, and they're very smart and they explain things well, and they're very interesting people, but they don't have that kind of spark of adventure and excitement and kind of pushing the frontiers that I get from the exoplaneteers.
Perhaps you see in children that are 7 years old. I mean,
perhaps,
in
yes.
that best sense of the word, this curiosity about the world.
Yes, but it's also, I think, has to do with the fact that the exoplaneteers, almost all of them, with very few exceptions, are really interested in the question of whether there's life out there.
Uh-huh.
And so it's that childlike question that they were trying to answer.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Michael Lemonick. We're talking about his book. It's called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. We have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University supports WHYY. At Drexel University, the co-op experience is more than an internship. It links the classroom with real-world experience in the workplace, helping to transform Drexel students into entrepreneurial professionals. Most co-op experiences are paid positions, which can help offset tuition fees and loans after graduation. More information is available at drexel.edu/thinkingforward. Drexel University. Thinking forward. Mary Monica Mitchell writes popular etiquette columns, but her new book is very personal. It's a clever series of emails with the late Philadelphia communications professional Nessa Foreman, who died of cancer last year, a woman Mitchell calls her sister by choice. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Mitchell talks about her intimate exchange about love, etiquette, vulnerability, and ultimately saying goodbye. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Are you a breast cancer survivor? Do you have hot flashes? The Integrative Medicine Program at Penn Medicine is studying ways to improve the quality of life of breast cancer survivors. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of acupuncture or medication to treat hot flashes. Initial evaluations determine eligibility. To learn more about Penn's Integrative Medicine Program, 215-349-5647. 215-349-5647.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And again, Michael Lemonick is our guest, author of Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. He's a senior writer for Climate Central, lead author of a book called Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Droughts, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. He was our guest on Radio Times just a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Sandy. And he's also a contributing writer for Time Magazine, where he has covered science and the environment for about two decades now. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Marty from Hopewell to join us. Marty, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I was wondering, when showing my children all the pictures and articles about the shuttle program being retired, and from what I understand, our astronauts are dependent on other countries to get them out to travel in space. Mm-hmm. It seems like the antithesis is sort of progress and a little bit of stepping backwards, which it sounds like from this program is really not at all the case. And so I just was wondering if I could hear about that.
Indeed. Thanks, Marty. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, so the human spaceflight program and the scientific space program are two separate things within NASA. In both cases, they actually have stepped back from their dreams of what they really wanted to do because they just don't have enough money. In the case of unmanned space probes, it's not so obvious because, you know, if they go up a couple times a year to different places, and if, you know, they take out half of them, you still have them going up every year and you still have results coming in. So it seems as though it's just continuing. The bigger, more ambitious space probes out to the outer planets are fewer now, but we still get these amazing pictures from Jupiter and so on. So you don't really notice. With human spaceflight, if you don't have a shuttle, you got nothing. And so, and they got to the end of the shuttle program without having a good plan in place for what comes next. And so it does seem to be a stepping backward and sort of we're on hiatus in a way.
Do you think that's a mistake? I mean, that we're not sending human beings, the U.S. is not sending human beings into space?
This is a question that's very difficult for me to answer because on the one hand, if we want to learn about the universe and learn what stuff is made of and what Mars is like and what the outer planets are like and what the planets around other stars are like, unmanned space probes and space telescopes are vastly, vastly more efficient. You can learn so much more for so much less money, and you don't put anyone's life at risk. Human spaceflight is inspiring and extraordinary, and it's got a lot of sort of inspirational value that may make up for the fact that it's so expensive and so dangerous. But I go back and forth on whether it's really worth it.
And I don't know if this is a question to whether, because there's a limit to how far human beings can go, that has kind of limited the science that can be learned from human space travel.
Well, it's no, I don't. I mean, we can go pretty far. You may even be old enough to remember when we landed on the moon.
I remember it quite well, as a matter of fact.
And at that moment, it was the idea that we would not be walking around on Mars by the year 2000 was just absurd. Obviously, we would be. And then we'd be sending people out to the asteroids, and we'd be exploring the solar system with people. And we could have done it if we'd made the decision to do it and spent the money to do it. And we would have learned an enormous amount that way. So, yes, there are limits. We're not going to send people to Alpha Centauri
no.
for take 100,000 years. But there's plenty of real estate in this solar system that we could have been exploring by now with humans. Would we have learned much more than we have by sending out robotic probes? I'm not sure. So maybe we'd have learned, 40% more. I don't know. I'm just making that up.
Sure.
But it would have cost tens upon tens of times as much money, and people would have died. And so is it worth it? I just don't know how to answer that.
It's a fair question, I think, for all of
a
us to grapple with. Let me get David from Lansdale to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Michael. I have a question about how effective crowdsourcing the search for planets is. Like, I belong to a group called Planet Hunters, and you can look at the transits of planets. Like, you can look at the transits in front of stars, and then if you mark down the transits, and then you submit your results, you submit your research to the organization that's doing the research.
Yeah.
And I guess they do this because there's so much information, there's so many stars to look at that they open it up to the public. And I'm wondering how effective it is in actually finding new planets.
David, I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, in fact, I write about planethunters.org in the book. It's extremely effective because Planet Hunters has actually found planets and found planets in the Kepler database that the Kepler people did not find.
Wow.
And these have been confirmed and published, and I wrote about one a few weeks ago. The way it works is that the Kepler mission is looking at so much data that it has to screen things with software. So the software looks at each star, and if the software notes, hey, this looks like a signal of a planet, then humans go in and look further. But there are some signals that are so complicated or messy or noisy that the software just rejects them because it can't handle them. The software can't deal with special cases so well. And a group of people had the brilliant idea of saying, well, look, the human eye is one of the greatest pattern recognition computers. It is the greatest pattern recognition computers ever designed. Let's have human eyes look at some of these difficult cases. And so you can go online at planethunters.org
so cool.
and start looking at these light signals. And if you think you see the signal of a repeating transit of a planet in front of a star in these messy data, you flag it. And I don't know how many thousands of people are registered on the site, but there are many thousands. And sure enough, people have said, hey, this looks like a planet to me. I don't care what the software says. And they go back to the Kepler mission and say, please take a look at this. And the Kepler scientists look at it in more detail. And in certain cases, they've said, yes, guys, you have found a planet that we missed.
David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You wrote about a Dr. Marcy wanting an international project to launch a probe of Alpha Centauri.
Oh, yes, Jeff Marcy. So Jeff Marcy is, again, one of the older generation of scientists who labored in obscurity. While Bill Borucki was trying to get the Kepler mission built to look for transits, to look for stars, planets passing in front of stars, Marcy was out looking for those wobbles I talked about earlier
yes.
with a different technique, and he labored in complete obscurity and was actually the subject of ridicule by some of his colleagues for this ridiculous project. And he just kept working away and working away and working away, and he was actually scooped on that very first planet in 1995. It was a star he had looked at, but the planet was orbiting so fast that he never expected that, and he didn't look for that in his data, and neither did the other guy who found it. But Marcy went on immediately to find dozens of more planets. He is the most prolific human planet hunter in history. Kepler is the most prolific planet hunter, but it's not human. And so he is now this senior statesman, very eminent astronomer, and he has the liberty to think outside the box and to daydream and to challenge NASA to do what's right. Yes, he wants NASA to put all of its resources into, not all of its resources, a lot of resources.
But a lot more of its resources.
Into a mission to Alpha Centauri. And this would not be cell phones.
Yes.
It would be a more substantial probe, and it would take a long time to get there. It would use some kind of new propulsion technology, but it would take 100 years to get there. But he thinks that's a grand, ambitious, bold step that NASA could take, and I think he's right.
Let me get, looks like Autumn from Newark, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Autumn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is, I was wondering kind of what you were just speaking about, but what's the ultimate goal and purpose of all this exploration and the space probes? If we can't afford to have a space program, do we expect to be able to actually reach these planets, or is it just to get the information? What's the ultimate goal or purpose of it?
It's a good question.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
So the purpose at this point is knowledge, is just to find out whether there are other planets out there, whether there's life in the universe beyond Earth. And we're looking for it on Mars right now, or at least evidence that it might once have existed on Mars. We may someday look for it on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter that has an ocean underneath a thick layer of ice where life could conceivably exist. And we want to know if it's if there's life on some of these planets we're discovering around other stars. We're not going to go there, almost certainly. But what we can do is build telescopes powerful enough to detect the atmospheric signature of life, the signature of oxygen and methane and other substances in the atmosphere that are a giveaway to the existence of life. So that's what it is. It's the answer to that question. Is there life out there in the universe?
Autumn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Michael, you mentioned Voyager. This is about 35 years after its launch. It's going 11 miles a second. It's 11 billion miles from the sun. I mean, it's moving fast, but it's got a long way to go.
Well, it's not going anywhere in particular. So it's just going. Yeah, it was designed to look at Jupiter and Saturn, and when it went past Jupiter, Jupiter's gravity flung it out at high speed toward the outer solar system in no particular direction. Its mission was done, and it gave us spectacular pictures of Jupiter. Now it's just kind of humming along, and because it's still humming, they're still NASA's still listening to what it has to say, and it's detecting particles and detecting what it may be, particles that show it's at the edge of the solar system, but it's not headed anywhere in particular.
I've interviewed you a lot about science and some of the books that you've written and things that are happening both on the Earth and up in the universe. And in this book, you write about your father, and you write about the fact, how he inspired you to love science and to have this kind of passion and curiosity about science.
That is right. When I was very young, he would tell stories about science. He was a physicist, so he told stories mostly about physics. I never heard anything about biology, but physics and astronomy. And we lived in Princeton even then, but the whole family was here in Philadelphia, so we would go to family parties, and we'd be driving back late at night on Route 1, and you know, my brother and I were in the back seat. It was dark, and he would tell us these stories about the stars and the galaxies and the atoms and the molecules, and he was such a great storyteller. He turned science into a story. There were no equations. I didn't have to do any problems, but he told stories about the universe, and I think it was because he was such a storyteller that I fell in love with the universe and wanting to know about it and wanting to understand what it was made of. And the kinds of things he was telling me about in the early 60s have been so far surpassed by what we've learned since that the story never gets old.
Huh. What were his last words?
His last words. So he was in a semi-coma, and I walked into his hospital room and I said, "Dad, what's going on?" You know, because try to sound cheerful with somebody who's dying. I don't know why. But just something to say. And he roused from his coma and he said, "The Earth goes around the sun. That's what's going on." And I was like,
wow.
I was taken aback with that kind of voice. And it reminded me of how deeply he was in love with the universe and knowing how it worked and the fact that we could even figure out how it worked. I mean, that's amazing in itself. Mm-hmm. So basically, he told me one last story that the best he was able to tell at that point.
And he was a professor at Princeton.
Professor of physics at Princeton.
Wow. Let me get Matthew from Wilmington to join our conversation. Matthew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
In keeping with the idea of stories, I was wondering if your guest could talk about any stories, whether speculative fiction or nonfiction, that he enjoys reading that kind of encourage him to think about the universe in different ways. And thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome, Matthew. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I'm kind of stuck in the '60s in many ways. So
you and a lot of other people, but yeah, go ahead.
So when I was growing up, my father also introduced me to science fiction, and mostly the science fiction of Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov, and then there was Robert Heinlein. I could never stand him. I don't know why. But Clarke and Asimov both created fictional worlds that kind of made you think about the universe and what it's made of and how it's put together and why is it this way and not some other way and what if it was some other way. And so reading those stories, it would just kind of transform my worldview in ways that have stuck with me ever since.
Mm. Matthew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you think scientists and science writers want the same things?
Well, no. Scientists generally want to understand the universe at some level, whether it's biological or astronomical or climatological, and really just understand how things work. Science writers want a good story that they can sell their editors. Seriously,
and it's that crass.
Well, if I bring my editor something that's kind of boring, she's not going to let me write about it. And so I need a good story, not just a fact, not just a discovery, but a story of how it happened and what it means and why you should care. And for many scientists, it's just leave me alone. I want to learn science. I want to do science.
Well, always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Michael Lemonick has been our guest. His book is called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. And again, he's a senior writer for Climate Central, a contributing writer for Time magazine. And we do call him up from time to time when there are things to talk about of a scientific nature. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.